Welcome back to the second hour of this week's Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Each week at this time, I bring you an LGBT and teen news magazine produced out of San Francisco called This Way Out. After that, we'll be bringing you some more shotgunning of shorter news segments I could not fit into the first hour of this week's show, including Media Minutes, Radio Spin, and Peak Oil Check-In, to name a few. That's the type of alternative non-corporate voices we bring you each and every week on The Mike Cannon Show, and we'd like to thank you for taking some time out of your day to listen. Thank you very much. Here is This Way Out.
You're just in time. Enjoy the show.
We could get married in California, but the problem for us is that we couldn't stay in California, or we couldn't stay in the U.S., which is confusing to a lot of people.
When we made this film, you know, we spent 4.5 years making it. We put all of our heart and soul into it because we loved Don Bacardi so much, and we were so touched by their story, his story with Christopher Isherwood, their love story.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A Budapest court calls rock-throwing anti-pride protesting free speech. A binational queer couple is forced into love exile. And the post-cabaret stories of Chris and Don. All that and more this week now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Pam Marshall.
And I'm Chris Wilson.
With NewsRamp, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 12, 2008. A Hungarian court ruled this week that dozens of violent extremists who pelted Budapest pride marchers with eggs, bottles, and rocks on July 5th were merely exercising their free speech rights. Charges were dropped against more than 40 protesters who were arrested at the scene. Three others were acquitted, and four were slapped with minor fines, and the latter only for refusing to obey a police order to disperse. Police used water cannons and tear gas to disperse the protesters at several points along the Pride March in downtown Budapest. A police van was set on fire, and several Pride marchers suffered minor injuries in the melee. Two gay businesses were firebombed during the week leading up to the march. After several years of peaceful events, right-wing resistance to lesbi-gay legal advances in Hungary, including a registered partnership act giving same-gender couples many of the rights of marriage, which takes effect in January, may have fueled the first organized attacks against Budapest Pride last year and the renewed assaults this year.
But hundreds of thousands of LGBT people and their allies filled the streets of Madrid on July 5th in a colorful display of pride in one of the world's most queer progressive countries. Equality Minister Bibiano Aedo led the parade under a hot sun of more than 30 floats and sound trucks blasting techno and Brazilian music. She told reporters that it is a day of joy to demand the rights of people and all citizens. A float entered by Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero's Socialist Party, a multicolored double-decker bus, sported a large building equality banner. In 2005, Spain became only the third member of the European Union, after the Netherlands and Belgium, to legalize marriage equality. Several members of the conservative opposition Partido Popular and their allies in the Roman Catholic Church continue to demand repeal of that law, leading several pride marchers to carry signs proclaiming secular state.
An estimated 300 people also marched under sunny skies in Lisbon in the Portuguese capital's 9th annual pride parade. Participants chanted, "Portugal needs to come out of the closet," and "No to the dictatorship of heterocultivation." The current government has rejected any move to change Portugal's marriage laws to accommodate same-gender couples.
About 50 people staged a pride march in Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic, in late June. They carried rainbow flags and beat drums as they walked through the historic downtown section of the city. Local media reported that the marchers urged passage of legislation protecting LGBT people from discrimination. Marchers also spoke out against Roman Catholic Cardinal Nicolás de Jesús López Rodríguez, who, in an October interview with the newspaper El Nacional, reportedly referred to gays as maricones, or faggots. López Rodríguez has also called LGBT people lacras sociales, according to a 2006 Associated Press report, which could be translated as social waste or social scum.
Police estimated that 825,000 people celebrated Pride in London on July 5th, making it the largest such event in UK history. Members of all three branches of Britain's armed forces marched in uniform for the first time. Wearing a pink cowboy hat, recently elected Tory Mayor Boris Johnson was booed by some along the parade route for comments in a book he wrote 7 years ago comparing same-gender civil partnerships with a union between three men and a dog. LGBT activists have generally said they're reserving judgment to see how Johnson behaves as mayor. Ben Summerskill, chief executive of the leading UK advocacy group Stonewall, told reporters that all politicians are on a journey, and his journey seems to be heading in the right direction. Sir Ian McKellen and other Stonewall members met with British Prime Minister Gordon Brown prior to the parade to discuss combating homophobic bullying in schools, which McKellen called hugely important.
British Equalities Minister and Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, Harriet Harman, was booed as she spoke from the main stage at the post-parade rally in Trafalgar Square. Hecklers were protesting the government's treatment of lesbian and gay asylum seekers in the UK from their queer-oppressive countries, including recent high-profile cases of gay and lesbian refugees from Iran and Nigeria. All have expressed fear of being killed if forced to return to their native countries. Home Secretary Jackie Smith last month refused requests for a moratorium on the deportation of lesbi-gay Iranian asylum seekers in particular, claiming that the evidence does not show a real risk of discovery of or adverse action against gay and lesbian people who are discreet about their sexual orientation. Longtime activist Peter Tatchell called that complete nonsense and deeply insulting, adding that it was like saying that Jews in Nazi Germany were safe if they hid their Jewishness. But a Scottish asylum immigration tribunal this week rejected the refugee application of now 19-year-old gay Syrian Jojo Jaco Jacob, even though the ruling acknowledged that his home country represses homosexuality. Homosexuals have to modify their behavior and lifestyle accordingly, they wrote. We find no evidence that in Syria he would conduct himself other than discreetly to avoid repercussions. It's not clear if the gay teenager can appeal the ruling.
But Sweden's migration board has ruled that Iranian gays and lesbians who seek asylum there will get it if they were out of the closet while living in their homeland. The board concluded that such individuals are at risk of persecution if they're returned to Iran. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has infamously claimed that Iran has no homosexuals, but a sodomy conviction can bring the death penalty under his country's Sharia or Islamic law. Iran is believed to have used it since the Islamic Revolution somewhere between a few and thousands of times. Western gay activists with an interest in Iran have for years debated at length how often Iran executes adults for consensual same-gender sex, if it does at all. Accurate information on the question seems to be impossible to obtain. In its reports about Iran, Human Rights Watch has said that at minimum it has documented brutal floggings imposed by courts as punishment and torture and ill-treatment, including sexual abuse, in police custody.
In other news, Malaysian opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim has once again been accused of sodomy. He was convicted in 1998 of that charge and corruption, although the country's high court overturned the sodomy conviction and freed him from jail in 2004. The former deputy prime minister, who's married with six children, had been the heir apparent to then Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad before he vocally opposed his mentor's economic policies. He was arrested for sodomy and corruption soon thereafter. Anwar and his supporters have always claimed that the charges were trumped up by the government to discredit him and prevent him from becoming prime minister. He's now back in politics following a five-year ban because of the corruption conviction. His opposition, People's Justice Party, made significant gains in recent elections against the ruling National Front coalition government of current Prime Minister Abdullah Ahmad Badawi, Mahathir's hand-picked successor. There are no laws against homosexuality in Muslim-majority Malaysia, but sodomy, even between consenting adults, is punishable by up to 20 years in prison. Saying that the government was trying to cause anxiety and disgust among Muslims against him, the 60-year-old Anwar has strongly denied the latest charges made this week by a 23-year-old male staff member. Anwar told reporters that he has strong evidence to support his innocence, but said his lawyers had advised him against elaborating because the investigation is ongoing. Abdullah's government has denied any suggestions that the new sodomy accusation is politically motivated.
In the U.S., the director of North Carolina's State Standards Laboratory, which calibrates equipment measuring everything from the weight of medicines to the weight of trucks on the highway, retired this week rather than follow the governor's order to lower U.S. and state flags to half-staff to honor former Senator Jesse Helms, who died the week before. L.F. Eason III, who'd worked for the state for 29 years, said in an email message to his staff that the notoriously racist and anti-queer Helms had a doctrine of negativity, hate, and prejudice, and advised the governor and other supervisors that he could not in good conscience honor him. Helms consistently opposed any LGBT-positive legislation during his long career, railed against government support for LGBT artists, and once said of gay men and HIV/AIDS that it's their deliberate, disgusting, revolting conduct that is responsible for the disease. Specifically citing opposition by Helms to the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the late senator's filibuster to stall efforts to make Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a national holiday, the 51-year-old newly retired Eason told an interviewer that everything he did was such a disservice to this state, I don't see how anybody could celebrate his career.
And finally, the American Family Association has called for a boycott of global hamburger chain McDonald's. The right-wing group is upset that the fast food giant has joined the National Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce, given it money, and put one of its executives on the group's board. The AFA claims that its nearly 3 million supporters don't want to spend money at establishments that actively promote the homosexual agenda, including homosexual marriage, though there's no indication that McDonald's has ever specifically endorsed marriage equality. In a resolute response to the AFA boycott announcement, however, McDonald's USA spokesman Bill Whitman said that hatred has no place in our culture. That includes McDonald's, and we stand by and support our people to live and work in a society free of discrimination and harassment.
Ba-ba-bum-bum-bum. I'm loving it. That's News Wrap for the week ending July 12, 2008. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm Pam Marshall.
He was a camera, he's an artist, and now they're in a moving love story together later in the program.
And then you pay the price, the things we do for love, the things we do for love.
While freshly legalized lesbi-gay wedding bells are still ringing fast and furiously in California, state-level marriage equality does nothing to solve the problems of American gays and lesbians in relationships with non-U.S. citizens. So, like the African slaves of another century, many of these same-gender couples are jumping on a new underground railroad to find freedom in Canada. They get support preparing for and adjusting to their relocation from a group called Love Exiles. This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching chatted recently in Vancouver with one former Californian who changed countries so she could finally settle down with the woman she loves.
Nadine is from California, but you're living in Vancouver now.
I've been living in Vancouver since September.
You're here because your partner is, you were saying, from Malaysia originally.
Uh-huh.
And I guess, and you wanted to be together, and I'm curious, because now that same-sex marriage is legal in California, can you guys go back to California and get married? Do you still need to be here?
Well, we could get married in California, but the problem for us is that we couldn't stay in California, or we couldn't stay in the U.S., which is confusing to a lot of people, including a lot of Americans. The way that it is in the States is that immigration is considered a federal issue, and so if the federal government were to recognize our marriage, be it that we're married in California or somewhere else, then we would be able to presumably have the right to have our partners get a green card through us and that whole process that heterosexuals are able to do. But unfortunately, the federal government doesn't recognize same-sex marriage, and so therefore we wouldn't be granted that privilege that heterosexual couples get.
Gotcha. You're part of a really interesting group called Love Exiles, which is kind of a loose-knit community of binational couples who have settled in Canada. But before I ask you about them, I'm just curious if I can ask you a bit more about your own experience first in terms of, you know, what you've gone through.
We met in 2003. She was in the U.S. at the time as a student, and she was studying in California. And I was in graduate school in Washington, D.C., and we met on the internet.
Oh, wow.
And so once I was done with my coursework, I moved to California so that we could be together. And it's actually pretty funny because my mom, when she found out that I met a girl on the internet, she was, you know, really supportive that I pick up and move across the country to live with her because it brought me closer to my family.
So how hard was it? I'm guessing your partner was in the U.S. on a student visa of some kind.
She was, yeah.
So what did you guys, how long was she able to stay in the States?
Well, she originally didn't come with the intention to stay. She came as a student, and she went to university and got her bachelor's degree. And she was then able to work for a short period of time through optional practical training is what they called it. It's kind of an opportunity for people who've become educated in the U.S. to get like an extra year. And then she went to graduate school for a little while to kind of extend her stay a little bit more, and then got a job offer. And her employer was able to sponsor her and get her the work permit to be able to stay, but that only last for a few years. I think it might be something like 5. And at that point, we were together. And so we knew that that work visa was going to run out eventually. And there was the possibility for the employer to sponsor her for a green card. But it's a really long process. It's really expensive for the employer. It forces you to have to stay with the employer, you know, and it kind of creates a situation that can be harmful to the employees sometimes because the employer knows that, you know, you aren't going to go anywhere. And so that was kind of what we were dealing with. And we really felt at that time like our lives were on hold because we were considering Canada and we were considering coming in as skilled workers. And so as a part of that, you have to show that you have, you know, income sufficient to sustain yourself. And it's something like $10,000 to $12,000 for a couple. And so being that I was still a graduate student and she was supporting us, we were having a really hard time, you know, trying to skirt the money together. And so it was really stressful, and it was really difficult for us, too, because we wanted to do things like settle down and, you know, think about buying a place. And we couldn't do that because we didn't know where we would, you know, end up living to get, whether we'd be able to stay together and if we were going to have to move to another country.
Mm-hmm. So how did you end up applying to come to Canada then? Did you apply as skilled workers?
That was the plan, but then we were fortunate because in BC, I think it's relatively new. It's the PNP, the Provincial Nominee Program. And I don't know it very well. My partner would be much better at explaining it. But basically the way that it works is that employers in Canada or employers in BC can kind of nominate someone that they'd like to hire and say, this is somebody that we think really fits the job well, and we weren't able to find somebody locally who can do this job, and so we really want them to come here and fill this position for us. And because of that, we didn't have to wait. We didn't have to, you know, show that we had the money saved and do all of that. It was much quicker. So that was really lucky for us. She applied for a job, and she applied for several jobs because when we were thinking that we were, you know, ready to make the big move, that seemed like the faster way to do it. And so she was lucky that she, you know, got the interview, and they really liked her. And I think she interviewed sometime in maybe it was May, and in July she got the job offer, and in September we moved to Vancouver.
Oh, fabulous.
Yeah.
Wow. Did you apply for immigration as her spouse? Or
Yeah, we were lucky because, you know, Canada is much more progressive than the States in that way, in that they recognized our relationship even though we weren't married. They recognized us as common law spouses because of the time that we'd, you know, been living together and all of that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. You both have some kind of residency then that allows you to work here?
Right, right.
Oh, cool. Right.
Yeah.
So if people want to find out more about the Love Exiles group, how do they find you?
There's a website, loveexiles.org, and that takes you to the Love Exiles webpage. And then there, if you click on resources, I think that's where you go to find out how to hook up with the different listservs.
Gotcha.
And if that's not true, then there's a contact email you can, you know, write to Love Exiles directly and ask them, you know, how to get patched in.
Great. Well, Nadine, thank you so much.
Thanks for covering the topic.
And our thanks to This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching in Vancouver.
Hello, this is the actor Michael Emerson. I play Ben on Lost. It's not easy being one of the others. So if time travel or moving the island isn't an option and you're feeling sort of lost, try listening to Greg and Lucia on This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
Sally walks away with a green fingernailed wave as Brian's train pulls out of the Berlin station. But then what? This Way Out entertainment correspondent Steve Pride finds the next chapter in a heartwarming new documentary called Chris and Don, A Love Story.
What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum.
The film Cabaret was based on the adventures of Christopher Esherwood, as chronicled in his Berlin stories. So in the sequel, I suppose we'd learn our hero left Sally Bowles and Berlin for sunny Santa Monica, where he lived until his death in 1986 with portrait artist Don Bacardi.
My name is Tina Mascara, and I'm the co-director of Chris and Donna Love Story with my partner Guido Santi.
I'm here. Ready to.
What sort of feedback have you had from audiences so far?
So far, audiences really seem to love it, which really pleases us immensely because when we made this film, you know, we spent 4.5 years making it. We put all of our heart and soul into it because we loved Don Bacardi so much, and we were so touched by their story, his story with Christopher Isherwood, their love story. And the feedback has been really wonderful.
What inspired this? What got you involved in this?
I first got involved because I was introduced to Don Bacardi through one of the producers of the film, Julia Scott. Her family befriended Don Bacardi and Christopher Isherwood for many years. And I just arrived in the States in 1990s. And eventually I met him. I became friend with Don. And one night he showed me this amazing 16mm footage that he shot with Christopher Isherwood as they were traveling around the world in the 50s. And I was so impressed. And I was surprised that nobody ever asked him about the possibility of making a documentary on his life story because it's so extraordinary. Both Don and Christopher Isherwood were pioneers in being openly gay as a couple in the 50s, and they were 30 years apart. So they had a very interesting story.
You mentioned the age difference. How old were they when they got together?
Christopher was 48 years old and Don was 18. He looked much younger. He actually met Christopher Isherwood when he was 16 years old, but they didn't start their affair until 2 years later on Valentine's Day, 1953.
And certainly the trouble is that he looks so young. If you see pictures of Don Bacardi when he was in the 50s, he looks like 12. So a lot of people thought that Christopher Isherwood, the renowned British writer, was having an affair with a minor. And this was the scandalous aspect of it. But in reality, they were adults, both of them.
I was stunned, though, when I finally heard Christopher Isherwood's voice. Talk a little about sort of the melding that happened.
I always like to repeat what Don says, is that he's an unconscious impersonator. I'm very familiar with Don now, so now I just think he sounds like Don. But I think the first time that I heard Christopher Isherwood speak, I was just floored how similar the speech patterns. He has this Oxford kind of British accent, his mannerisms, his the way he pauses, the way he chooses his words. Everything is very much Isherwood. I think the way he wears his hair. Now I even know he wears Christopher Isherwood socks sometimes for good luck.
Yeah, red socks.
Chris was very famous for wearing red socks.
Red socks.
And Don, sometimes I look down at an art show or something and I see those red socks.
What do you want the audience to take away from the film?
This is a great love story, and it's a story of commitment. It's a story of watching two artists grow. It's the emergence of an artist, and I think what I want people to come away with is that it's a story of love, and love is powerful, whatever gender you are, whether you're heterosexual, homosexual. Love is love, and that it's powerful, and that I want people to respect that and to really admire these two human beings.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me about Christopher Isherwood. What was he like?
Oh, he's the most charming man I ever met.
Writer, artist, activist, Don Bacardi.
What was wonderful about him was his genuine curiosity about people. When we met, he asked me all kinds of questions about myself. Until I met him, I'd never known anybody to take such an interest in me. And he was particularly interested in young people and young men in particular. And he wanted to know what their lives were like, what it was like to be them, what they were interested in. And you can always tell when somebody asks you questions, whether they're just making conversation, whether it's just idle curiosity, or whether it's the genuine article. And his was genuine.
You're quoted in a book on gay widowers by Eric Guitarez as saying that after the death of Isherwood, you transformed yourself and underwent a complete role reversal in the relationship that followed.
Yes, well, it was a very peculiar experience for me. First of all, reaching the age that Chris was when I first met him. Of course, he seemed so much older, and he was distinguished and from another generation, another country. And suddenly, I found myself the very age he was when I met him, and that was very significant. And he was still alive then. And then after his death, I found myself gradually being put into the position of being the older one of a couple. I met a young man, fell in love with him, who was 26 years younger than I was. And I suddenly found myself cast in Chris's role. And it was very illuminating for me because it gave me all sorts of insights into situations that I'd experienced with Chris, and I suddenly, for the first time, began to understand how he must have felt all those years before with me. And also, his example was very helpful to me, because often when I had problems with my friend, I would ask myself, how would Chris behave in this situation? And you know, I always got an answer. And it was often very, very helpful to me asking Chris's advice.
This has been a conversation with portrait artist Don Bacardi. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
I don't love what you do. No, it's not just a word. To love and be loved is to hear and be heard. It's perched on my heart. It's splendid. It's bold. It's the wings of home. It's the wings of my soul. Now I know I can love. I can love and be loved. Ooh, I believe, I believe, I believe in love.
Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Pam Marshall, Chris Wilson, Rex Watson with Bill Kelly, Heather Kitching, and Steve Pride contributed program material. 10cc, Liza Minnelli, and David Brown performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. To CDs or cassettes of all our programs there. To receive weekly email alerts describing the content of each This Way Out, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 2BAY Byron Bay, New South Wales, WDFH Ossining, New York, KRUX Las Cruces, New Mexico, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Late last week, Federal Communications Commission Chairman Kevin Martin told the Associated Press that he had completed a six-month investigation and determined that Comcast violated the agency's principles of open access on the Internet. Responding to a complaint filed by Free Press and its allies in the SaveTheInternet.com coalition, Martin's move sends a strong signal to Internet service providers everywhere that violations of net neutrality will not be tolerated. Marvin Amore, general counsel of Free Press, authored the complaint against Comcast. He explains that the cable giant not only tampered with Internet traffic, but lied about doing so.
In mid-2007, there were reports from users that Comcast was interfering with their connections. Specifically, Comcast was blocking different kinds of file sharing, wasn't letting people share files with each other through BitTorrent, Nutella, and other file sharing services. Comcast denied for months. And then the Associated Press and independent testing by Rob Topolsky and Electronic Frontier Foundation proved that Comcast was lying. Comcast was actually secretly blocking consumers' ability to access file sharing protocols.
This decision is the first major test of principles outlined by the FCC 3 years ago.
In 2005, the FCC unanimously adopted a policy statement explaining how the FCC interpreted the Communications Act. And the FCC said, going forward, we're going to ensure under this policy statement that consumers have access to all lawful content online and are able to use all software applications that they want online.
Though the decision will not become official until a full commission vote on August 1st, Martin's willingness to rule against Comcast is a victory for open Internet advocates.
The chairman of the FCC announced that he would circulate an order to the rest of the commission to punish Comcast for what it did and establish baseline protections for an open Internet going forward. We're optimistic that this will be a good first step to protect consumers' access to the Internet.
Millions of people across the country have contacted the FCC and Congress expressing their concern over the future of the Internet, but there is still more to be done.
This process can go in one of two directions. The Commission could continue handling these problems on a case-by-case basis based on complaints by consumers, or we could move to a broad rulemaking at the Commission rather than complaints, or legislation from Congress.
For more information, visit SaveTheInternet.com.
The cost of text messaging is rising again. T-Mobile announced that it will join AT&T and Verizon Wireless in charging 20 cents per message. And AT&T announced that texting for new iPhone users will cost an extra $5 for 200 messages. It wasn't that long ago when many carriers offered free texting. But a 100% price hike within 2 years has some people looking more closely at the cost. A space scientist from England's University of Leicester calculated that texting is now at least 4 times more expensive than transmitting data from the Hubble Space Telescope. A blogger figured out that if the same pricing per text on a per-byte basis was applied to downloading a single 4-megabyte song, it would cost the user almost $6,000. A software developer computed that at 15 cents per message, the markup for text messaging per kilobyte is 7,314%. There have been no further costs to the cell phone companies that would necessitate a price hike. And in fact, the cost to carriers to transmit text messages is next to nothing. Here's why. When a cell phone is on, it is constantly connected to a cell phone tower as it waits for a call or other data. The phone and the tower send little packets of information to one another to keep in touch. These packets hold 160 characters. That's why a text message can contain only 160 characters of text, because they hitch a ride on these data packets. So compared to the costs associated with email or downloading data that need their own bandwidth, charges for texting are exorbitant. So why are cell phone companies continually hiking up prices for texting? Text messages are bringing in huge revenues to cell phone operators. Verizon reported a 33% increase in data services over last year. AT&T's wireless business profits were up 22% this year. As wireline revenue continues to decline, companies will be looking to their wireless divisions to continue their high profits. Consumers can do little to stop escalating prices. As the cell phone industry consolidates, there is less competition to keep prices in check. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
Welcome to the weekly radio spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Sari Williams.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. In our top spin, the United States Senate is set to address the need for a federal shield law for journalists. But the White House is sounding the alarm about the effect on fighting its war on terror. The Bush administration claims that the law would, quote, wreak havoc on national security and completely eviscerate the ability to investigate terrorism, end quote. But even some Republican members of Congress feel that the role of a free press is just as important. Republican Senator Mike Pence of Indiana countered that, quote, the only check on government power in real time is a free and independent press, end quote. The proposed legislation provides protections for reporters to guard sources who are key to stories about government corruption and wrongdoing. The bill has been nearly unanimously endorsed by the state's attorneys general and is supported by both major party presidential candidates. A similar bill passed the House of Representatives last year with overwhelming support.
If you attend a festival this summer, don't be surprised if you run into the National Guard. The military branch is launching its Rockstar Hero Challenge campaign in order to boost recruitment. The effort includes a tour bus with large touchscreen displays that let potential recruits see and participate in virtual missions. There will also be interactive kiosks where visitors can pose with images of rock bands. Promoters hope that this will tie into the, quote, rockstar quality, end quote, of Army National Guard members. The Guard's plan is to visit nearly 50 events and do outreach to as many as 5 million people. The focus will be on places where the National Guard's target demographic is likely to be in attendance, events like music festivals, NASCAR races, and fishing tournaments.
British environmental activists took to the streets of London this week. Their target was the headquarters of the PR giant Edelman. Members of the Oxford Climate Action Group said that their demonstration was to call Edelman to task for its greenwashing, especially on behalf of their energy client, EON. They hoped to, quote, highlight the insanity of investing in new coal power stations in the face of human-caused climate change, end quote. In addition to their presence on the street, some protesters entered the PR firm's offices, while others unfurled a banner from the building's roof. Edelman's CEO posted a video blog expressing regret that the protesters didn't choose to have a conversation with him instead. He also said that the police and other public services had better things to do than monitor the protest.
North Carolina Senator Elizabeth Dole made a very unexpected suggestion this week. She wants to name a pending HIV/AIDS bill after her predecessor, Jesse Helms. The longtime conservative senator died on July 4th. Helms was nicknamed Senator No for his opposition to many pieces of legislation, including civil rights bills and the Martin Luther King Jr. national holiday. But Helms saved some of his strongest words for gay rights and AIDS funding. Helms had this to say on the Senate floor during debate on an AIDS bill.
Do you realize that if they would stop what they're doing, there would not be one additional case of AIDS in the United States of America? I've never heard once anybody say to the homosexuals, stop what you're doing.
In later years, Helms said that he changed his mind about AIDS funding in Africa. But his change of heart did not extend to American gays, saying that homosexuality, quote, is the primary cause of doubling and redoubling of AIDS cases in the United States, end quote.
And now it's time to play 6 degrees of spin and fakin, our look at the connections between media manipulators. We just mentioned North Carolina Senator Elizabeth Dole. She and her husband, Bob Dole, have both run as Republican candidates for president. But Liddy Dole started her political career as a Democrat, working in Lyndon Johnson's administration. She then became an independent and finally a Republican. Under Ronald Reagan, she was the Secretary of Transportation and was Secretary of Labor under George H.W. Bush. In 1991, she left government to head the American Red Cross. A Nation magazine investigation showed that she compromised Red Cross programs to shore up support for her husband's presidential bid. She changed HIV and AIDS manuals to cater to conservative Christian sensibilities and offered seats on the Red Cross's prestigious Board of Governors to Bob's biggest campaign donors. Her tenure at the Red Cross saw a large exodus of accomplished personnel, ineffectiveness in the face of national disasters, and charges of sloppy handling of the nation's blood supply.
That's this week's edition of the Weekly Radio Spin. For more information, visit the Center for Media and Democracy's website at www.prwatch.org.
I am so, so sorry for everything that has happened. Because in spite of what Mike says now, it is my fault. And this is where we've ended up. Hungry and cold and hunted.
This is the Corporate Watchdog Radio headline news. The U.S. can achieve 20% energy from wind by 2030 with help from GE and T. Boone Pickens. The U.S. is poised to produce 20% of its energy with wind power by 2030, according to a new Department of Energy report. Wind currently accounts for 16.8 gigawatts, a little over 1% of U.S. electricity generation. Reaching 20% by 2030 means adding almost 300 gigawatts of wind capacity. This requires increasing annual wind installations threefold from about 2,000 a year now to 7,000 10 years from now. Challenges include costs of new transmission lines and where to site them. Iowa, Minnesota, New Mexico, and Oregon currently get 3 to 5% of their electricity from wind, and Denmark gets 20%, supporting the notion that the DOE goal is achievable. General Electric has sold $4 billion of wind turbines and technology this year so far, two-thirds of its 2008 goal. Famed Texas oil baron T. Boone Pickens has bought 700 of those turbines. A recent wind convert, he's got a plan to displace the country's dependence on foreign oil with wind energy for electricity and, controversially, natural gas for autos. Sierra Club director Carl Pope welcomes the Pickens plan, and blogger Joseph Rahm calls the wind half of the plan brilliant. However, Rahm calls the natural gas half dumb for continuing to fuel climate change. And two quick updates from previous CWR headline news segments. On July 8th, the European Parliament voted in favor of including aviation emissions in the EU's emission trading scheme as of 2012. And on Monday, the EPA released a report linking global warming to human health problems. Last year, the Supreme Court ordered the EPA to regulate greenhouse gas emissions if this link is proven. But last week, the Bush administration blocked EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. For the Corporate Watchdog Radio headline news, I'm Bill Bowie.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. GM, America's fourth largest company in annual sales, said Tuesday that it's making more deep cuts to survive a harsh economy. GM jobs have gone from 107,000 hourly jobs in 2004 to 74,000 today. Buyouts and early retirement incentives will slash even more of those as some new workers are added at half the pay. The new cuts include selling off $4 to $7 billion in assets, slashing salaried jobs and benefits, and suspending the GM stock dividend. GM CEO Rick Wagoner called this an unprecedentedly difficult time. He said these cuts are necessary for GM's survival. Workers at the University of California's 10 campuses went on strike Monday. Jesse Russell reports.
Members of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union walked off the job at 10 University of California campuses on Monday, protesting a pay scale they say is 25% less than what workers with similar jobs are paid at community colleges and private hospitals. The workers are paid on average $10 per hour, and they perform food service, medical, bus driving, and janitorial duties at the campuses and university hospitals. The union was under a restraining order issued by a San Francisco judge on Friday, but the strikes are a signal that the union plans to ignore that order. Nearly 20,000 workers are represented by the union. Contract negotiations have been at a standstill since the contract expired, and they have been working without a contract since January.
Senator John McCain calls Social Security a disgrace, but the AFL-CIO says it's an American success story, it's not broken, and it's not a disgrace.
The Labor Federation says Social Security is the cornerstone of American retirement security, and McCain wants to gamble it away with risky privatization and diversion schemes that will only weaken it. McCain, the AFL-CIO notes, has used every opportunity to vote to replace Social Security with private accounts that will undermine the system. What millions of Americans who depend on Social Security need, the AFL-CIO says, is a president who will strengthen the system, protect it, and bring it into long-term balance. AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades Department President Mark Ayers says that Senator John McCain has failed veterans in the U.S. Senate.
Not only has he voted the wrong way on veterans issues, such as opposing increased funding for veterans health care the last 4 years in a row, but he also doesn't support middle-class workers' issues. As veterans, we respect Senator McCain's military service to our country, but we don't respect his record in the United States Senate.
The Tenement Museum on the Lower East Side honors the history of New York City garment workers who organized unions to better their lives. But UAW Local 2110 organizer Eden Schultz says the museum isn't honoring its own workers' wishes to have their union recognized.
It is pretty ironic that their own employer is trying to push them away from a union that they want.
Get more labor news at laborradio.org.
You know you
workers
only have one shot
we can review.
To make it right.
I'm Doug Cunningham.
To do the right thing. So listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
You can't leap into sustainability. That's what environmental educator David Orr frequently said when I worked with him at the Environmental Education and Demonstration Center he founded in Arkansas, the Meadow Creek Project. We were trying to show what sustainable living could look like in the Ozarks of the 1980s. The conference center was the largest solar-heated building in the state. Many other buildings were chock-full of energy efficiency measures and other aspects of sustainability. And the farm and forestry projects were designed to make best use of what the land offered, while improving the land's productive capacity. Yet we did all this while purchasing supplies, or at least household goods, from Walmart, and driving gasoline-powered vehicles, because that's what was available to us. I thought of those contradictions while visiting Solarfest this last weekend. Solarfest is an annual music and educational festival around renewable energy, held on a farm in the heart of Vermont. It started 13 years ago as a music festival powered by solar electricity, and it has evolved into a three-day celebration of renewable energy in summer and nature and, well, life. The two stages and five workshop tents are still powered by solar electricity, and the attendees who camp there shower in solar-heated water and leave a pretty small footprint on the land. Still, most of us arrive by gasoline-driven car. The $20 parking fee encourages carpooling, and some people hitchhiked in. Some people undoubtedly drove cars running on waste fryer oil. I left Solarfest on bicycle, but my bicycle and I were both transported there by cars. A wood-powered pickup truck was one of the demonstrations, showing the wood gasification technology that was used rather widely during World War II, and probably one or two people came to Solarfest in it. Porta-potties collected our feces and urine instead of composting toilets that would have cycled the nutrients and organic matter back into the soil. And most events took place inside of tents made of nylon, or some other petrochemical fabric. You can't leap into sustainability. David Orr is right. What you can leap into is a mindset that sustainability is important, and that we have ways right now to drastically reduce our dependence on oil, coal, and gas. What's striking about Solarfest is how thoroughly it allows us to leap into that mindset. Out on a Vermont farm, in an area with no cell phone coverage, surrounded by thousands of people who have decided that Solarfest is where they want to spend their weekend, we can get a glimpse of the future. We can crawl into the children's play structure made of cob, cordwood, old bottles, and other recycled materials. We can eat lunch with a person who has lived happily with no refrigerator and using just a few gallons of water a day for over 25 years, and hear from a man devoted to keeping his ecological footprint down to his fair portion of the planet that he's conscious of sharing with 6.7 billion other humans. We can learn how to extend Vermont's short growing season with hoop houses and row covers to harvest summer crops in the spring and grow plants that would normally only grow in Pennsylvania or further south. And we can entertain ourselves with real human clowns and puppet shows and singers and dramatic readers, leaving the iPods and video games at home. Solarfest has always been a family-friendly event, and it is raising children who have had it as a natural part of their summer. In its 14th year, Solarfest now has a series of workshops directed to the children of Solarfest. Some are for younger children, like the one that advertises, "Superwoman gets her power from the sun. Spider-Man fights Dr. Octopus, who builds his very own sun. Storm fights bad guys by making wind. Come learn what amazing things even non-superheroes and sheroes can do with alternative energy sources." Others are aimed at young adults, like Rock the Vote, What Young Voters Should Know About Elections and the Environment. You can't leap into sustainability. The end of the age of oil, however, may be marked with some steep downward leaps in the amount of fossil fuel energy available to us. Thanks to Solarfest and similar gatherings around the world, we are raising some members of a generation who are more comfortable with those leaps and more prepared to grow food, stay warm, and have fun with a lot less oil. On vacation with my bicycle in Peru, Vermont, I'm Carl Ettinger, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
If you would like to conduct an eye-opening or maybe even eye-popping experiment to discover how much food you waste, start composting. There are tons of benefits to composting. It's great for your gardens and flower beds, and it allows your food waste to return to the cycle of the food system instead of ending up in a landfill. The biggest thing I've learned so far in my first year of composting is how much food and food-related waste we throw right into the garbage. Allow me to digress here and admit that I am no compost expert. As a matter of fact, I was yet again reminded by this experiment that I utterly lack patience. I constantly find myself standing over the compost bin, poking at its contents with a stick, and demanding that it turn to compost now. Compost, I've discovered, stubbornly refuses to acquiesce to intimidation and insists you simply wait for it to work its magic. I chose the compost bin method, but a lot of other people, especially those with no yards, have written to tell me how much they love worm composting. You can compost with worms right in your own basement. As much as I love the thought of receiving thousands of earthworms via Federal Express, I had already purchased a bin, so I stuck with that method. You don't really have to buy a bin. There are lots of websites to help you make your own. The general rules to composting are to put all leaves and grass trimmings in the bin. Coffee grounds and eggshells are nice too. Basically anything biodegradable and all vegetable matter can be composted. Fat, mold, and animal products except hair should not go into the compost bin. Another helpful hint to speed up the process is to cut or shred everything into the smallest bits possible so that it breaks down faster. Keep the compost in a warm spot, away from the house by a few feet, and stir it frequently. So what's stopping you? You can start composting today with a simple bucket until you have something better. In the meantime, I'll be giving my compost bin the evil eye and yet another vain attempt to speed things up. I'm sure you'll be far more patient than I am. From RestaurantWidow.com, I'm Lisa the Waitress, and you've been listening to In Season with Lisa on WCRS, LPFM, 102.1 and 98.3, Columbus.
Attention. The Intra-Universal Weather Service has issued a severe red giant warning for the sun named Sol in the Charon system, in the outer arm of the Milky Way galaxy, 12 parsecs from Coruscant. The sun is a massive incandescent gas. It is due to turn into a red giant and, 4.6 billion year. If you are in the area of the solar system, please seek shelter by developing some reasonable space program that will get your behinds off that doomed planet.
Okay, coming up next, a short 5-minute awesome audio stylings from the group at WBAI in New York.
Welcome to Without Comment. I'm Dred Scott Keyes.
The cartoon is titled The Politics of Fear, and it shows Barack and Michelle Obama fist bumping. Michelle is carrying an AK-47, and the senator is wearing a turban and Muslim dress. An American flag is burning in the fireplace beneath what looks like a portrait of Osama bin Laden on the mantle. Critics say the latest cover of The New Yorker is feeding into fear tactics.
To be funny, it has to be totally absurd. And on this one, the absurdity may be just too real.
In attempting to satirize something, they probably fueled some misconceptions about me instead.
A whole lot of people didn't find anything funny or artful about it.
The new Newsweek poll found that actually more than half of all respondents think that Barack Obama was either raised as a Muslim, educated at a Muslim school, or was sworn in as senator on a Quran. So the question is really, why do so many people have this sense?
Once you spread a rumor, once you get a rumor on the internet, it spreads like wildfire.
It happens so fast. There's an anonymous smear, and it gets forwarded, and then it gets cut and pasted.
They are hard to stop, no matter how responsible we in the quote-unquote mainstream media are.
Was Senator Barack Obama schooled in Islamic radicalism when he was a little boy?
Have you seen that photo circulating on the web now with Obama dressed in sort of Kenyan Muslim garb?
He is averse, for example, to putting his hand over his heart during the Pledge of Allegiance.
You took the oath of office on the Quran.
Reference to white people as whiteies.
It's curious that a magazine would go to this length to make this kind of a statement when you consider that a portion of this country, particularly in Midwestern and Rust Belt states, still believe that Barack Obama, because of internet campaigns, mistakenly and wrongly believe he may be a Muslim, and they equate that with terrorist activity. It's puzzling, and if not outright belittling, that they would do this to this candidate at this point. I've never seen a candidate treated like this.
Barackinophobia! It is defined as the irrational fear that behind the mild-mannered facade, Barack Obama is intent on enslaving the white race.
He attended a madrasa,
a radical Muslim school.
The Muslim
whitey.
Whitey.
Hard time proving that he's not Muslim.
Why does Michelle Obama sounds so bitter and angry as she campaigns for the White House?
She even sounds really bitter.
This week, Michelle Obama still sounds angry.
Who is the real Barack Obama?
Obama, Reverend Wright, and Farrakhan on the cover of Trinity Church's magazine.
Caught on tape, making some comments that people are describing as sexist. Barack Obama, number one radical liberal in the Senate. Radical.
Barack Obama on drug legalization and needle exchanges.
We're talking about the new preacher at Obama's church.
From spy suspect to Obama delegate.
Here's Barack Obama, and here's Ahmadinejad, the Holocaust denier.
This is actually an insult against Muslim Americans, something that we don't spend a lot of time talking about, and sometimes I've been derelict in pointing that out. And for this to be used as sort of an insult or to raise suspicions about me, I think, is unfortunate. And it's not what America's all about.
It's about the accusations being leveled at the Obamas. And so I think in that way, the cartoon or the illustration may have misfired a little bit.
If people think that we think that any of these things are true, we want to assure them. We know they're not, and that's why we do this cover.
The New Yorker does do this. I mean, they do caricatures of political figures all the time. But to be frank, it was a little bit over the top, to say the least. Pretty tasteless. I think something that, you know, didn't need to be done, but, you know, they're a magazine. They're trying to sell their magazines.
All this is nonsense.
Good humor is understood by everybody, not just by a select few. And even if this was meant to be good humor, only a select few understand what it's trying to get across. There are lots and lots of people for whom it may reinforce whatever fear they have about Barack Obama, thinking that he might be a Muslim, thinking that he might be a sympathizer with terrorists. And we all know that's not true. And it's especially mean to Michelle Obama. She and her husband really are the all-American couple. And for them to be pictured this way as some kind of a satire really does them little help.
Ultimately, it's a cartoon. It's not where the American people are spending a lot of their time thinking about.
This is the right way.
And you've been listening to Without Comment. I'm Dred Scott Keyes.
Summer Gorgon.
Here's my boomstick!
The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard Mondays from 2 to 6.
I'm with another gentleman here who's at the anti-Nazi protests. And I
this is Mike Cannon. I'm with Becca, who has returned from Palestine for the fourth time.
I'm with a vendor at the energy fair here who has biodiesel.
This is Mike Cannon. I'm with a group, the RNC Welcoming Committee for the Republican National Convention that's going to be coming up.
Need is still here, even in Algiers, where a lot of the community businesses aren't open, and it's 100 times fold that in huge swaths of this town, like in the 9th Ward, where almost nobody's back because there's no infrastructure set up there. So
stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
And you too can stay current by checking out the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6 p.m. on this, your only not-for-profit, commercial-free community radio station, 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.